Hey, listeners, you're about to hear a Curbsiders Classic episode. If you heard it the first time, listen again for that space learning. But if you haven't heard it yet, then you are in for a treat. So without further ado, enjoy. And don't forget to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders if you want ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, it's pretty easy to convince ladies not to eat Tide Pods.
Oh, I don't like where this is going at all. All right.
But it's harder to deter gents.
All right. It was catastrophic in a different way than what I was anticipating.
The Curbsiders Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like Moral Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, probably the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is our second of two episodes on heart failure with Dr. Kittleson, Dr. Michelle Kittleson. This is our HEF-PEF episode, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And Paul, I know you're a huge fan of the heart failure acronyms.
Yeah, we didn't get into like HEF-MREFs and some of the more nuanced HEF-F abbreviations, but we covered a lot of ground here.
I think on the first episode we talked about heart failure improved EF, which is HEF-IMP-F, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yes, right.
So that one's great.
That's especially awful, yeah.
let's remind people what we do on the episode and then remind them who our guest is in case they haven't heard an episode before with Dr. Kittleson.
Sure, Matt. As a reminder, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And boy, howdy, what an expert we have for you. I assume that you've already heard our recent episode on HEF-REF, as you alluded to, from Dr. Michelle Kittleson. And Dr. Kittleson is back to teach us about HEF-PEF. Dr. Kittleson, as a reminder, is a lot of things, but she is a professor of medicine at Cedars-Sinai and director of education in heart failure and transplantation. She is also part of the ACC-AHA Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Guidelines and Heart Failure Guidelines. She's on the board of directors for the Heart Failure Society of America. She's the former interim editor-in-chief of the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation, associate editor for the Journal of American College of Cardiology, and her writings are available in all of the major journals. If you think of one that is important to you, her writing has been in it. So she's hugely impressive, and further so because she actually wrote down some of her words of wisdom, her Kittleson Maxims in Mastering the Art of Patient Care, which is available from Springer Publishing. And in this episode, she teaches us all about HEF-PEF, what guideline-directed medical therapy looks like, what things that we have evidence for, what things probably we should be doing even though the evidence isn't as strong, how to make the diagnosis, and then how to sort of guide patients to the process, what their timeline might look like, and sort of what to expect with these patients who actually may present very differently despite sort of having this very broad phenotype applied to them.
And a reminder to the audience that this and most episodes are available for all health professionals for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, access to the Discord, Cash Slack Vault, all sorts of cool stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Michelle, we're lucky enough to have you back for another heart failure episode. We've covered HEF-REF. Now we're going to do HEF-PEF. I know Paul loves those. You love those abbreviations, right, Paul?
Every single one of them. Yeah, big fan.
And since the audience knows, you know, they know your hobby is baking. They know you've written a book, but you're someone with a lot of advice to offer. So what is some advice that you might offer to the audience before we get into the clinical topic of this episode?
Absolutely. I would say the one most important skill to be a successful physician, to take the best care you can of your patients, is to have a checklist of things you need to do. And there's two kinds of doctors, the ones who write things down and ones that let things fall through the cracks. So whatever your system happens to be about following up with stuff, identify it and use it, because so much of medicine is just checking off the boxes and showing up.
Yeah, fantastic. There's whole books written about checklists. Checklist Manifesto is a good one if people haven't read it. And I love a good checklist. Paul, are you a fan of checklists?
No, I like to leave things in my inbox in perpetuity just to remind me that I haven't yet addressed them. And I feel like that's the best way to generate maximal anxiety while not actually accomplishing anything. So for all the young trainees out there, I recommend if you want to not sleep well.
Yeah.
You ever want me to take a look at your inbox? I'm really,
absolutely
I really,
not.
Yeah, I'm like the Marie Kondo of inboxes. So I'd be happy to help you tidy up.
Can we use that in promotion for this episode, the Marie Kondo of inboxes?
You may. I'd be delighted.
All right, Paul, let's get to the case.
Sure. Let's talk about, we'll call her Ms. Smith. Ms. Smith is a 62-year-old patient. She's coming to your office because she's been experiencing worsening shortness of breath, decreased exercise capacity, and she's had some lower extremity edema for about the past 3 months. So this is not an acute change. She has a past history noteworthy for her high blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, obesity with a BMI of 35, type 2 diabetes that is well controlled to metformin. She has a remote history of preeclampsia, and she smokes one cigar a week during her Friday Texas Hold'em poker nights. Just nothing ever during the Texas Hold'em poker? Okay. All right, that's fine. I thought it was fascinating. Did I ever tell you that I used to play Texas Hold'em poker? I would go to actually poker tournaments. I included that in my medical school application, and that was the one thing everyone asked me about. Like, no one cared about research or anything else, but invariably I was asked about poker specifically.
Why
so I'm just
have
we
never played poker together? Well, you've never invited me to play poker. This is the first I'm hearing about this.
It's because I value your friendship and I am the most competitive poker player and the worst loser that ever lived. Anyway, so back to Ms. Smith, forgive me. So she's having some worsening shortness of breath, increased edema, decreased exercise capacity over the past 3 months. She would previously walk the mall with her friends on Wednesdays, but she stopped doing this over the past month because she can't make it further than 200 meters between the Jamba Juice and the Hot Topic without taking a break. Though I would argue Hot Topic's a great place to stop. Her feet are so swollen that she can barely squeeze into her joggers anyway. A week ago, she woke up in the middle of the night feeling like she couldn't catch her breath, so she called an ambulance and went to the emergency department. They ruled out acute coronary syndrome and then treated her with albuterol ipratropium nebulizers, 2 doses of IV diuretics. And this made her feel a little bit better, and she was discharged home with instructions to follow up with her primary care doctor. Today, in her office, she still isn't feeling as good as she used to, but she at least made it from the car to the office without having to catch her breath. She's taken to sleeping in her recliner now, so she can't sleep in her bed anymore because it's so hard to breathe, so she sleeps in front of her TV set, and it's just better than laying flat. Her blood pressure, 146 over 92, and she did take her hydrochlorothiazide and losartan this morning. Heart rate is 94 and irregular, and she's breathing without difficulty. You cannot appreciate her JVP due to some challenging neck anatomy, but you do think that you hear NS3 gallop. So we've already given away the episode with the title for the listeners, so they probably figured out what we're going to be talking about here. But this is ostensibly a patient possibly with HFpEF. I don't even go with that. So tell us, I guess one of the reasons I hesitate to even call it that is because I'm still not entirely sure how it's defined or sort of how we even know if someone has HFpEF or sort of something else. So can you just sort of give us the 30,000-foot view and then we can sort of narrow things down as we get to know the patient better?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's a challenge too. I mean, HFrEF is easy. The echo shows you the ejection fraction is reduced. How hard could this be? HFpEF is much harder because there is no smoking gun to tell you, aha, I know exactly what you have. And you have to start with the cardinal symptoms of dyspnea and edema. And if you were to check an echocardiogram, the ejection fraction would be 50% or higher. But the first thing I always ask myself in this situation is differential diagnosis, right? The hardest thing to learn in medical school because patients don't have diseases, patients have symptoms. You have to learn how to work backwards. One of my other rules in life is don't memorize things, reason them out. Try to understand etiology through pathophysiology and anatomy. So let's start with dyspnea. Where could dyspnea come from? Well, it could be the heart's fault. And then what in the heart causes dyspnea? Well, it could be the heart muscle, a cardiomyopathy. It could be the arteries, coronary artery disease. It could be the valves, valvular heart disease. It could be the electrical system, arrhythmias, or the pericardium. What about the lungs? It could be the lungs' fault. It could be the airways, obstructive disease, the parenchyma, restrictive disease, the vasculature, pulmonary embolism, or the pleura. Or it could be other stuff like anemia, the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood is reduced, neuromuscular, they can't expand their lungs, deconditioning anxiety. So that's how you think about the dyspnea. Then what about edema? How do we think about the cause of edema? Well, we remember that edema comes from either increased hydrostatic pressure or decreased oncotic pressure. So increased hydrostatic pressure could be cirrhosis with portal hypertension, kidney failure, venous insufficiency, heart problems, cardiomyopathy, valvular disease, medications like calcium channel blockers, NSAID steroids. or it could be decreased oncotic pressure. Well, why do you have decreased oncotic pressure? You don't have enough protein. You're malnutrition. You are not making protein. Cirrhosis. You are losing protein through the kidney, nephrotic syndrome, or gut malabsorption. So when you think about it that way, when your patient shows up to your office with dyspnea and edema, and their ejection fraction happens to be 50% or higher, the first question I ask myself is, it actually the heart's fault? Maybe they have cirrhosis, portal hypertension. Maybe they have kidney failure and nephrotic syndrome. Maybe they have venous insufficiency. And you don't want, it's very hard if a patient's told they have heart failure when it's actually another organ's fault to unring that bell of misinformation and anxiety. So always try to figure out, is it really the heart's fault? Now, if you're convinced it is the heart's fault, the next question you must ask yourself is there an underlying cause for this? And that gets us to the universal definition of heart failure. So the universal definition of heart failure is pretty straightforward and obvious. You have to have symptoms of heart failure, okay? And you have to have some objective evidence that there's a problem with the heart, like cardiogenic, pulmonary, or systemic congestion. So symptoms of heart failure, that can include orthopnea, dyspnea, edema, elevated JVP, S3, hepatojugular reflux. So symptoms. And then what else is the corroborating evidence? Is there an elevated BNP? Is there objective evidence of cardiogenic systemic congestion? So that's how you think about the differential diagnosis of the presenting symptoms and then narrow it down to the heart.
Yeah, and I know there's this HFpEF score. What do you think about that? Are you a fan of the, it's like H2FpEF? However you say it.
You know, I think it's actually really nice because the H2FpEF score uses very clinically accessible, readily available variables to translate into score that leads to a probability of HFpEF. So what are they? H2, so there's two H's. H1 is heavy, BMI above 30. The second is hypertensive. If they're on two or more antihypertensive, since hypertension is so common as a comorbidity of patients with HFpEF, they have atrial fibrillation. They have pulmonary hypertension on their echocardiogram, typically because of chronic elevation of their left-sided filling pressures. E, elder, age above 60 years. And they have evidence of elevated filling pressures on their echocardiogram by their EE prime ratio of the mitral valve. So the H2FpEF score will use things you have anyway, just by seeing the patient and getting their echocardiogram, and a score of 6 or higher is suggestive. So I find it useful, almost more just to remind me of all the comorbidities that are common in HFpEF, but like with anything, you can't hang your hat on one test result. You have to interpret it in the lens of your pretest probability of the patient's other history and physical exam findings. And the most important thing you do not want to miss in someone who presents with dyspnea, edema, and a preserved ejection fraction when you are confident it is the heart's fault is amyloidosis. You guys have a whole amazing episode on cardiac amyloidosis, but it's not one you want to miss. And you might still have an elevated H2FpEF score, so you must not let it lead you down a path without considering the entirety of the patient's history, past history, physical exam.
I will say I had one patient since our amyloidosis episode that presented with it, and the resident that I was working with actually had listened to it and was like, I think we should do this testing. And, you know, it went very smoothly and we all felt very smart that we were able to make the diagnosis because of that episode. So it's, people should listen, go back and listen to it.
And you saved that patient's life because you, without considering amyloidosis and your differential diagnosis of a patient with HFpEF, you're withholding life-changing therapy that can help them live longer and stay out of the hospital. So kudos to you and your resident.
And to the people that haven't heard that episode yet, we talked about on that episode that in some studies, up to 15% of patients admitted with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction could be found to have amyloidosis, cardiac amyloidosis. So you really should think about it. It's not like this crazy zebra that you're never going to see in your career.
Amen.
This episode is brought to you by Figs. Here at the Curbsiders, we are always talking about the latest medical breakthroughs. But if I'm being honest, there was one thing we weren't seeing any major advancements in, and that's medical scrubs. The scrubs I used to wear were stiff and itchy and boxy. They definitely did not fit right. And then about 5 years ago, I noticed that my colleagues who still wear scrubs looked comfortable and looked good, and probably we have Figs to thank for that. Figs are made for all of us in healthcare. They are lightweight, breathable, antimicrobial, and they have pockets. For your stethoscope, your pager, that parking ticket you forgot to validate, all of it. Watto owns 5 pairs of Figs, and when he is wearing scrubs, he doesn't wear anything else. I mean, he's wearing Figs as scrubs. He likes his Figs scrubs is what I'm trying to convey here. And we at the Curbsiders have teamed up with Figs, and Curbsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off. This episode is brought to you by the Permanente Medical Group. Are you a primary care physician ready for a new change of pace? The Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, is calling your name. Experience the flexibility of a 4 or 5 day work week with hybrid practice options and a schedule that works for your life. Join their multidisciplinary practice and provide patient care without the headaches of overhead, billing, or RVUs. The benefits? Their competitive salary and benefits package includes competitive compensation, Northern California home buying assistance, moving and relocation allowance, comprehensive insurance, 3 retirement plans including a pension, and they're PSLF eligible. From breathtaking natural surroundings to vibrant cities, they have locations throughout Northern California and Central California that you'll love to call home. Want to join thousands of physicians who've made TPMG their career destination? Discover more at northerncalifornia.permanente.org. Again, that's northerncalifornia.permanente.org.
All right. So our patient is coming in with dyspnea and edema, and we talked about how those can come from lots of different things. So we have our differential. Anything for you that you put more weight in, like on the history and physical, to say that this person probably has HFpEF and not something else?
Yeah, you know, when we think about cardiac causes of dyspnea, edema with a normal ejection fraction, so we focused a lot on amyloidosis. It could also be valvular disease. It could be a pericardial disease, constrictive pericarditis. Could be hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It could be high output heart failure. Those are the other things on your list. Now, an echo is going to rule out most of those things. And your history is also really helpful. I mean, have I ever seen a case of wet beriberi causing high output heart failure? No, I have not. But if my patient has other evidence consistent with a malnutrition picture, it's going to raise a red flag for me. If they have a strong family history of sudden death and their walls are thick, maybe I'm going to think more about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. If they've had prior heart surgeries and they've got calcification of their pericardium on their chest X-ray, I'm like, wait a minute, am I missing something else? So there's so many clues you can draw from, really, from your history and then your echocardiogram to help differentiate. And when in doubt, you can do your directed amyloid workup. That's hugely helpful if you have smoking guns for amyloidosis, as we've talked about in the other episode, those red flags and clinical clues. But maybe you don't. Maybe you're like, I just don't know. The heart might be stiffer. Maybe it's a hemochromatosis. Gosh, maybe it's a pericardial disease. I don't really know. An MRI is useful in that setting. So I don't get an MRI in everyone with HFpEF, but I will get an MRI. They just don't fit my classic demographic, older, more likely a woman, comorbidities and diabetes, AFib, coronary disease, chronic kidney disease, hypertension, but they're presenting with a heart failure exacerbation. The other thing that leads me away from HFpEF is that they have a progressive decline, because every disease has a rhythm and a trajectory, and the rhythm and trajectory of HFpEF tends to be periods of quiescence punctuated by discrete exacerbations triggered by clear problems like she took an NSAID, she got fluid overloaded, she felt worse. And then they kind of go back to their baseline once their fluid balance is improved. Other conditions are far more progressive. things like amyloidosis, things like a constrictive pericarditis, you're very unlikely to get them to a point of perfection as you can in between bouts of exacerbations from HFpEF.
Oh, I never really thought of it that way. Yeah, because you do meet the patient once in a while that has HFpEF and they say, yeah, I had heart failure exacerbation like 3 years ago and I haven't really had trouble with it since. And sometimes they're not even on a diuretic or anything and they're just doing okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to ask about the BNP in this case, because it's something that I find kind of bewildering, especially since these patients phenotypically often have obesity as sort of part of what their phenotype looks like, which I think can also complicate it. So can I ask you, I guess, what the guidelines show or sort of how you use that and sort of what ways? We talked about this in our HFrEF episode, but I wonder if it's different in patients with HFpEF.
Yes, it is. So one of the pitfalls of using BNP to diagnose heart failure is that patients with HFpEF tend to have a lower BNP for the same level of congestion, volume overload, increased filling pressures than someone with HFrEF, and that's likely tied to obesity. So BNP is reduced in patients with excess adiposity. Why? Well, it turns out a high-fat diet can increase neprilysin. Neprilysin degrades BNP. That's the neprilysin inhibitor, so Cubitril, that's that enzyme. And also, the natriuretic peptide clearance receptors, there's more of them in patients who are obese, so they remove the BNP from the circulation. So that's the potential reason why. But on a practical level, you may find a lower BNP than you were suspecting. So if a patient comes to you with dyspnea and edema, and you have gone through the mental exercise to convince yourself it's not the liver's fault, it's not the kidney's fault, it's not just venous stasis or post-phlebitic syndrome from DVTs, you're convinced it's the heart's fault, and the BNP is low, don't just throw up your hands and say, oh, this can't be heart failure. It very well could be HFpEF, especially in someone who's obese, because in one study, 70% of patients with a BMI above 30 and HFpEF had a normal BNP. Don't let it dissuade you.
Yeah, and I was reading the Jack paper was talking about how some guidelines say you can use your what is an elevated BNP for patients with obesity? Maybe you lower the threshold by 50%. So let's say the threshold is going to be 500 for someone with obesity, you would put it at 250. But in the next sentence, they say, but that's not really evidence-based. So you can't really put too much stock in that.
Yeah. I rarely, if ever, check a BNP in anyone ever. Because I find there's too many pitfalls where it can be falsely low or falsely high. I feel it's trust your history and your physical. Check the JVP. It will serve you so much better than a BNP.
Yeah. I don't find it as clinically helpful either. And you just know it's a poor prognosis for the person if it's really high. I mean, that's kind of it. Okay. I know we're going to talk about medications, but we're talking about testing here with BNP. You mentioned the person should have an echo. Assuming we're not going to go down the amyloidosis diagnosis pathway, what other testing might you think about getting for someone if we're thinking they have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
You're going to want to pay a lot of mind to their comorbidities. So you will get your laboratories to look at their kidney function, their liver enzymes, their albumin. You'll get a urinalysis to look for proteinuria. You'll do that kind of due diligence. Lymphedema is something that's often placed on the differential. But, really on physical examination, lymphedema is quite distinct from edema. And there's, the skin is often thickened. There's this thing called the Stemmer sign, where there's thickened skin at the base of the second toe or second finger. So you can't pinch it because there's skin fibrosis in addition to edema. Not a great sign. There can be false positive in obesity, but just really you should think about lymphedema as its own bucket of a vascular condition. You may want to get an abdominal ultrasound to look for cirrhosis in some of these patients. And then again, do they have chronic kidney disease? Do they have diabetes? Do they have coronary artery disease, hypertension, obstructive sleep apnea, atrial fibrillation, these other comorbidities that need to be optimally managed?
So let's talk about managing these other comorbidities. Like what special considerations do we need to have here?
Yeah. So hypertension, right? Kind of just whatever works is the right answer. You want a medicine that controls the blood pressure, minimizes side effects, but it would be nice to give something that does double duty, right? So thiazides are great for, we know that they can reduce the progression or the incidence of heart failure. I also think the RNAs and the MRAs, for which there's some data in HFpEF, it'd be nice to use if you have an excuse to give an RNA, MRA, ARB, give it to someone for their blood pressure. When it comes to atrial fibrillation, really anticoagulation for thromboembolic prophylaxis is going to be indicated in just about everyone because their CHAD2 VAS score is going to be elevated because they have heart failure. They're typically old and they have a lot of comorbidities. You know, the benefit of rhythm versus rate control is still not 100% established. And for me, I go by symptoms. If they are well weight controlled and asymptomatic, the data, the guidelines certainly aren't strong enough to advocate rhythm control for all. Though there is some suggestion in some trials that rhythm control may improve outcomes. But really, it should focus on symptoms and on anticoagulation for stroke prevention. When it comes to chronic kidney disease, again, your friendly nephrologist can often assist you, but remember those medications that can also improve kidney function, like the SGLT2 inhibitors, the magical, mysterious SGLT2 inhibitors. And then sleep apnea. You know, there's no data to say that if you treat sleep apnea, heart failure gets better. But if you treat sleep apnea, patients feel better. So certainly screening with daytime somnolence, snoring, headaches, it's important to rule that out because if you can treat it, you'll improve their quality of life.
As America's primary care physician, Paul, do you feel like this is in your wheelhouse? It seems like it would be, you know, just managing comorbidities.
Yeah, bread and butter. Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess along those lines, I wanted to ask, yeah, because it's going to come up. So weight loss specifically, I wonder if you couldn't speak to the benefits there. And also, is that independent of things like improvement in sleep apnea or atrial fibrillation? Like, you know, is it going to improve things regardless or does it improve things? I guess I'm leading the witness here a little bit.
Yes, you're allowed to lead the witness. So I'll talk about the non-pharmacological interventions. And it is absolutely clear that weight loss and exercise improve quality of life and exercise tolerance in patients with HFpEF. There's beautiful trials to show that things like calorie restriction by 400 calories a day or supervised exercise training 3 days a week, like a cardiac rehab type program, help patients with HFpEF feel better quality of life scores and also better exercise capacity and things like 6-minute walk test or cardiopulmonary exercise stress testing. It is a grave injustice, I think, that insurance in America does not cover cardiac rehab for HFpEF, only for HFrEF. And there's many people working very hard to change that because exercise training makes a huge difference. And I think what that speaks to is that I think of HFpEF as the rheumatology of cardiology. Like HFrEF, it's all about the heart. But HFpEF is a multi-system condition. There's so many intertwined comorbidities. You're exactly right. Exercise and weight loss will make your blood pressure better. It will make your AFib better. It will make your diabetes better. It can make your coronary disease better. So everything feeds on everything else in a condition like HFpEF, which is also why, quite interestingly, that if you look at the survival of patients with HFpEF, their cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular causes of mortality are evenly split, unlike someone like HFrEF, speaking to how that this is a global condition and often a condition of aging, so it needs a multidisciplinary approach to improve quality of life as well as outcomes.
So the medications, it seems like it's been harder to find a medication that has like a clear, really strong benefit in people with HFpEF. Why? Can you speculate a little bit as to why that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can think of HFrEF as a triumph of translational medicine, where our understanding of tiny little molecules has translated into therapies that help patients feel better, stay out of the hospital, live longer, potentially improve heart function. We know about our neurohormonal axis of the sympathetic nervous system, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, the natriuretic peptide system, the SGLT2 mysterious system, and it's amazing. Everything just seems to work. The problem with HFpEF is we don't understand those pathophysiological mechanisms at all. There is no unifying pathophysiological mechanism. There's observations, but there's no whole. And likely that's because HFpEF is a heterogeneous condition. There's different phenotypes, let's say. There's some people have predominantly right heart dysfunction with pulmonary hypertension. There's other people who have more chronotropic incompetence. There are other people who have more diastolic stiffness. There's other people who have more differences in their skeletal muscle oxygen extraction. Others who have differences in their vasculature. So these different phenotypes all lumped into a trial, we're not sure what therapy pinpoints what patient. And that has been the huge challenge of randomized controlled trials of therapies for HFpEF.
So in the past few years, it seems like they've started to add the SGLT2s and the ARNIs were added. So maybe if you could talk us through that evidence a little bit, and are they for everybody like they are with HFrEF or not?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. Okay. Diuretics are going to be a necessary evil. You're not going to give a patient a diuretic. If they need a loop diuretic to help them feel better and breathe, give them their loop diuretic. But what else is out there? Really, SGLT2 inhibitors are the first medications to meet their primary endpoint in a clinical trial of HFpEF. Hugely exciting. We have the DELIVER trial, we have the EMPEROR PRESERVE trial, dapagliflozin, empagliflozin, in patients with symptomatic HFpEF meet their combined endpoint of a reduction in death and cardiovascular hospitalization. If you look at the 2022 heart failure guidelines, it gives it a 2A indication, which isn't as strong as a class 1. Why wasn't it a class 1? Well, historically, at the time the guidelines were published, only one of these two trials had come out. So the committee wasn't clear if it was a true, sustained, reproducible benefit. Now it's clear. SGLT2 inhibitors for everyone across the spectrum of ejection fraction. Give it to your patients with heart failure. The next medicine that I would put on that list to me is quite fascinating, which is spironolactone. So the TOPCAT trial came out 10 years ago, took patients with symptomatic HFpEF, randomized them to spironolactone versus placebo, did not meet its primary endpoint of a reduction in death and heart failure hospitalization, but did meet its secondary endpoint of a reduction in heart failure hospitalization. And so everyone was like, meh, not so great. But the clinical trialists looked at the data really closely and said, there's something really funny here. It's very funny that this is an international trial and half the patients are from North and South America and half the patients are from Russia and the former Soviet state of Georgia. And these two populations are dramatically different. The Russia-Georgia patients have very low event rates, like 1 to 2% by the end of the study had death or heart failure hospitalization, 20-something percent in the Americas. And patients in the Americas who were assigned to spironolactone had a bump in their potassium and creatinine when they took it. Patients in Russia and Georgia did not. Really concerning. Was there some clinical trial and nefarious goings on? We will never know. No one will ever repeat the trial. And I'm the first one to tell you that subgroup analyses are inherently hypothesis generating. However, the North and South American subgroup analysis of the TOPCAT trial did show spironolactone had benefit. So I do believe it is beneficial for our patients. The guidelines will give it a relatively weak class 2B indication because it didn't meet its primary endpoint. Maybe better for women, maybe better with men with ejection fractions on the lower end of the spectrum. But for me, I do put it very close to my SGLT2 inhibitor based on that analysis.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of these patients have hypertension too. It's a good hypertension medication. Right. So,
yes, better than hydralazine, let's say that.
I mean, that's a low bar to clear, but sure.
Fair enough. So now, you know, the sacubitril valsartan, the ARNI, has gotten a lot of press because of the Paragon HF trial. Symptomatic HFpEF, ARNI versus placebo. It did not meet its primary endpoint of a reduction in death and cardiovascular hospitalization. It also did not meet its secondary endpoint of a reduction in cardiovascular hospitalization. But, you know, the pundits out there were like, well, the p-value is 0.056, and if there were just X number more events in the placebo group, it would have been positive, but it wasn't positive. And then you have the subgroup analysis. Well, there's a signal for effect in women. There's a signal if your EF's on the lower end of the spectrum. But subgroup analyses are hypothesis generating. So it does get a 2B weak indication in the guidelines. And I say, if I have an excuse to give it, gosh, you're still hypertensive after your SGLT2 inhibitor and your spironolactone and your ES a little bit lower. Yeah, you happen to be a woman. Let me put it on board. But as we talked about in the HFrEF episode, cost becomes an issue. Now, if I'm going to spend my money on a drug that's not generic, I will spend it on my SGLT2 inhibitor over the ARNI. And if they need something for blood pressure, I'll reach for the ARB. Now, the ARB evidence is like 20 years old. Charm Preserve came out in 2003. Other studies show that maybe ARBs aren't that great in symptomatic HFpEF, but certainly no harm. And that would be my next line if I have an excuse to give it for blood pressure.
Yeah, so it's just not, you know, because for the guideline-directed therapy for HFrEF, I think almost everything is a class one indication.
Yes.
Is that, yeah, so these 2B is like, it goes like 1, 2A, 2B, right?
Yes.
So it's
yes.
Not...
Diuretics are a class one because they're a necessary evil. SGLT2, I think, will become a class one. We should think of them
right.
as class one. And then I do think spironolactone should be up a little bit higher. But then the ARNI and the ARB, if you have an excuse to give it for blood pressure, give it.
Okay, fair enough.
Where are we with the GLP-1s? Because I feel like this should be slam dunk home run.
Yes.
Like there's the weight loss, so that's great. But then also I think they're approved for cardiovascular risk reduction, which many of these patients would have those comorbidities. So I would think
yes,
you would expect the trials to be amazing and there'd be parades about them. But I've not heard a whole lot definitive yet. So where do we stand with those?
Yes. So the landmark trial in HFpEF to date is the STEP HFpEF trial. So the STEP HFpEF trial took about 500 patients, symptomatic HFpEF, obesity. The median BMI was 37, so quite obese. They gave them semaglutide. So actually, guys, did I pronounce that correctly? You're closer to GLP-1s than I am.
That's how I say it.
Cool. All right. Thank you. You say got semaglutide weekly for 52 weeks. So after a year, the primary endpoints were quality of life, 6-minute walk test. Patients walked farther. They felt better. They also had a reduction in weight over the first year, 13% reduction in weight. So that's the only endpoints we have thus far in HFpEF. We have they lose weight, which is not a surprise. We have that they feel better and that they walk farther. So your next question, of course, is going to be, well, is this because they lost weight or is there some magical intrinsic benefit to the GLP-1s? And no one knows yet in HFpEF. A subgroup analysis by degree of weight loss of STEP HFpEF showed that, in fact, the patients who lost the most weight felt the best and walked the farthest. So not a medical mystery here. We need trials with longer endpoints, which will answer that question. What you alluded to, Paul, was the SELECT trial, which is also very, very exciting for us cardiologists. These took patients who had coronary artery disease and a BMI 27 or higher. Average BMI was 33. And they gave them semaglutide, followed them for about 3 years. And they found that the cardiovascular endpoint, composite of death from cardiovascular causes, MI stroke, was reduced. So this is really, really exciting. The SELECT trial is telling us it doesn't just help you lose weight, it actually improves cardiovascular markers. Now, does it do that because you lost weight? I mean, it's hard to say because it's really hard to lose weight without these GLP-1 receptor agonists. But that's what we can say so far. And we look forward to studies in HFpEF to give us those clinical endpoints of death and hospitalizations. In the meantime, however, if you have a patient with HFpEF who would meet criteria to take a GLP-1 receptor agonist anyway because of diabetes, obesity, CAD, certainly that's a good excuse to give them one.
This episode is brought to you by Uncommon Goods. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I was actually looking through their website, and because I'm a selfish and self-centered person, immediately started looking for things for myself. One of the things I found was this Death for Dinner cookbook that has meals and drinks and munchies inspired by your favorite horror movies. Another thing I've got my eye on is this upcycled vinyl album cover display where they take a vinyl album, kind of crimp it so you can display album covers that are playing when you're playing your music. Very cool. I may even get around to looking for other people at some point because Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/curb. That's uncommongoods.com/curb for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I also wonder how much of just any of the benefits we're seeing with semaglutide and other meds like that are just because people just tell me it's like so much easier to control their eating. They you know, their snacking just goes away. Like, it, so the, and they, some people are just not hungry at all. So they have to, they're just, it's like easier for them to just be like, I'm only going to eat healthy foods because yes. I'm barely eating.
Yes.
Which, yeah. You know.
Yeah, the craving for the unhealthy food seems to go away. So it serves double duty. When you eat, it's healthier and you're eating less to begin with. I totally agree.
Yeah. And we know those foods. I mean, they're like, you know, the snack foods and the processed foods filled with all sorts of ingredients that are not good for the body. So maybe I wonder how much of it is the actual GLP-1 and what's doing to the body, or how much it's just keeping stuff out of the body that's really bad for it.
Yeah, I mean, and a good, you know, comparison would be, you know, bariatric surgery. You can achieve extraordinary weight loss, but, you know, I think the problem is it's a bigger barrier to overcome to go for a hugely invasive surgery than to right. take this amazing medication that works.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully by the time this episode airs, people will be able to get the medication. It's still very hard right now to... you can get it approved sometimes, but then the pharmacies don't have it still. But I imagine the supply will be ramped up, because I think those are supposed to be the most successful drugs of all time, or they're on their way. So we talked a little bit last time. You told us for HFrEF, you tell people salt and water. You're not super strict about it. You tell them they may or may not be more sensitive, and they can kind of play around with that. Is it any different for HFpEF, like how you talk to them about salt and water intake?
You know, it's actually very interesting, because with HFpEF, remember, their hearts are stiff. And when your heart's stiff and you have decreased compliance, little changes in volume can lead to big changes yeah. in pressure. So I often find that patients with HFpEF tend to be more salt sensitive than patients with HFrEF. Oh. So I counsel them a little bit differently. I tell them the same principle, which is salt is not inherently toxic to your heart. However, if you were to do the experiment of having a little extra salt and seeing if you felt more puffy and congested, chances are you would find out that there is a correlation there, and you will feel better if you avoid salt. So I do counsel them a bit more strongly than I do patients with HFrEF.
Okay.
And Michelle, when should these patients see you? My sense of things, and I'd be curious to know how others feel, is that these patients, for a couple of reasons, are less referred to cardiology or heart failure specialists. I think in part because the diagnostic criteria, people are kind of fuzzy about. They get these anecdotal diagnoses. We, for a long time, didn't have great evidence-based medications for them. So what was the point anyway? And so as a result, I think we just kind of neglected them and diuresed them as we needed to. So I guess, when should they see you, or when would you like to see patients with HFpEF diagnoses?
Great question. I think really, number one, if the diagnosis is unclear. So you have the patient, you say, I think this is HFpEF, but I don't really know if I've truly ruled out a severe valvular disease as contributing, or a pericardial disease, or could they have amyloidosis? And I've done the initial workup based on the amazing Curbsiders episode, but I'm still not sure how to put this all together. So number one, your diagnosis is in question. Second, I empower every internist, every clinician out there to start the foundational therapy. So diuresis, they need SGLT2 inhibitor for everybody. Do consider the MRA, and then lower down the ARB and the RNA. But say you do all of that and the patient just isn't feeling better. Like, they're having a trajectory that doesn't make sense to you. They're having frequent hospitalizations, and you feel like something is being missed. Something's not right. Maybe there's another diagnosis that needs to be entertained, or maybe they have more advanced therapies. And because this is a disease of older patients, typically things like heart transplant would not be indicated, or it would not be the right approach. But even just the counseling with a specialist to talk about prognosis and give them a better understanding may be useful. So if diagnosis is unclear, or what you're doing for treatment isn't working, please refer.
Yeah, I can get on board with all that. Well, this is our third heart failure episode with you now. This has been great. Thank you for updating us. And, you know, in the future, when more evidence accumulates, we'll have to probably do another one of these with you. But for now, what are some take home points that you'd like the audience to remember about heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
So number one, your patient presents with dyspnea and edema and their ejection fraction is 50% or more. First, ask yourself, is it the heart's fault? Don't forget, problems can be caused primarily by the liver, the kidney, things like venous stasis. Don't give the patient a heart failure diagnosis if it's not warranted. Number two, if you convince yourself it is the heart's fault, do not miss cardiac amyloidosis, a hugely pivotal diagnosis for which there is now therapy to help patients stay out of the hospital and live longer. And then finally, if you're convinced it's HFpEF and you're managing all the comorbidities, the best GDMT is SGLT2 inhibitors for everybody. Consider your MRA if you have an excuse about congestion or hypertension. And if you still have hypertension, consider your ARNI and your ARB.
All right. And once again, remind me, is there a book out there people should check out?
You're so kind to plug my book, Mastering the Art of Patient Care by Springer. And it's based on all the wisdom of my mentors and the mistakes I have made. So no one has to make them themselves. And it's very cool. I got an email from a trainee who told me that she just bought a copy for her best friend, which I think is great. Medical students should cooperate so everyone gets better as opposed to being competitive. So please buy a copy for your best friend.
Yeah. And, you know, aunts and uncles, whoever.
Sure. Actually, a patient see me in clinic yesterday, actually the wife of a patient. And she said, I love your book. And it was a little disconcerting because neither of them are in medicine at all. I'm like, how do you know about my book? And she said, I read it on your CV. And I was about to say, how do you know about my CV? But then I figured out we better just get back to the matter at hand.
We should say, Our producer, Deb, the great Dr. Deb Gore, said her favorite advice from the book was be nice and work hard, which is, I think, just how can you go wrong with that, following that advice, which is good advice.
Thank
especially,
you.
I need to remember the be nice thing sometimes, Paul. You're always nice, Paul.
That is categorically untrue, which you know, but I appreciate you saying that, at least publicly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. This has been great.
You guys are awesome. If you need anything else from me, you know how to find me. And I look forward to doing this again in a few years.
Hopefully with some peanut butter cookies as well.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Please also subscribe, rate, and review the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us on YouTube. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Deb Gorth, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Watto does our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye. We'll be right back.